tries to pull her hands away. But instead of being disgusted, the sight of the scars only seems to arouse him further. He bites them and traces them with his tongue. He kisses her neck and her collarbone, and his touch is rough, as though their wedding has made him bold. She has heard it is like that sometimes with mainland men, though she does not remember where she heard it. From Peter, perhaps, during her education, or from Genevieve, meaning to frighten her. Nicholas takes himself out of his shirt and works his fingers into the fastenings of her gown. Catherine turns away. Stop! Wait! She walks through the anteroom into her bedchamber. It has all happened so fast. The duel, her crowning, poisoning Arsinoe. She has had barely a moment to breathe, and now she feels all those missed breaths clawing at her throat.
Wait for what? Nicholas asks.
He follows her and kisses her shoulder, gentler now. She closes her eyes. In the morning, it will be over. She will execute Mirabella, and the hum in her blood will quiet, the dead queens of the Breccia domain satisfied. But even as she leans into her king consort's arms, she feels the dead queens picking at her, surging through her. They make her strong, and never leave her alone.
Peter, I should never have sent you away, she thinks, as she flinches from wetness left on her neck by Nicholas's kisses.
Nicholas stops. He pulls her up, holds her chin so she must look him in the eye.
Are you thinking of him?
He asks.
No,
she lies.
Good.
He picks her up and carries her to the bed.
Because he is not here.
The Volroy. Arsinoe's blood pounds in her ears as they head up and up the Volroy steps. She feels safer now that Jules is there, even though she is still in the lead. Part of her thought that when they freed Jules and Joseph, Jules would take over the escape. But they will get out either way. They reach the next floor and Arsinoe presses flat to the wall. This is the last gate. She remembers the ornate iron brazier in the center of the room from when they were being dragged down to the cells. She leans forward by a fraction and quickly leans back. There are so many guards, no less than 10. A few are seated around the rectangular table. Others lean against the walls. 3 stand directly beside the passageway through the gate. All are armed with clubs and knives. 2 carry crossbows. Arsinoe turns and holds up 10 fingers. Jules nods. Joseph's and Mirabella's faces pale. But there is no way out but through. Arsinoe takes a deep breath. She hopes that everyone knows what to do and that they are able to do it. She barrels into the room and runs headlong into the nearest guard, dropping her shoulder into his chest so hard that she hears a crack. That must be good, because he folds up and hits the floor without throwing so much as a punch.
The scarred queen! The queens! The guard by the gate shouts.
Chairs tip over as the guards at the table rise. They hesitate to raise weapons against queens, especially one who seems able to come back from the dead. Jules darts out from the shadow of the corridor and levels one of them holding a crossbow. Camden, snarling, quickly pins the other, and Joseph rips the weapon from his hands.
Quiet! No one move! Arsinoe commands, hands out. Get to the middle of the floor, lie on your bellies!
A guard wearing a black captain's sash shakes her head.
We can't let you out of here, my queen, she says.
You can, and you will, says Arsinoe. But the captain's hand goes to a short-bladed sword. She draws it and spins away from Arsinoe, aiming for Joseph. It is a fool's move. Jules's war gift stops the sword from ever coming down, and Joseph reflexively fires the crossbow. The bolt sinks deep into the captain's chest. The sight of their captain spitting red sends the rest into a frenzy. Arsinoe is immediately shoved and has to duck fast to avoid the swing of a black lacquered club. The sound of it ringing off the stones makes her dizzy. That could have been her head, split wide open. Ducked low, she grabs for the knife at the guard's belt and sinks it into his leg, then into his shoulder as he falls. Someone else's club catches her in the back. Her vision swims bright and dark, and she collapses onto the floor. There is so much noise, so much struggle. Someone steps on her hand and crushes it. Mirabella is screaming.
Jules,
Arsinoe groans.
Where is Jules?
Bones pop, and the guard who hit Arsinoe falls dead to the ground. Someone reaches underneath her and pulls her up.
I've got you, Arsinoe, Jules says. I've got you.
Arsinoe turns to look at her, and her eyes widen.
Jules, look out!
But before the knife can swing down, the attacking guard bursts into flames. Mirabella's face is furious, her fire so hot that the guard only shrieks for a moment. She lowers the fire as the stench of burned flesh spreads heavily through the air. Jules coughs amid the smoke and fires a crossbow bolt into the dying body to put him out of his misery.
I had to, Mirabella says.
Camden, who must have been guarding her, wrinkles her muzzle and slinks away to curl behind Jules's legs. Arsinoe looks around. It happened so quickly. Every guard is dead or unconscious. The room is full of sick-smelling smoke. Joseph is on one knee, panting from the exertion of the fight.
Let's get out of here, Arsinoe mutters.
Joseph stands, his right side dark with blood.
Joseph!
Jules slips out from beneath Arsinoe's arm and goes to him, pressing hard against the wound.
Here.
Mirabella tears more strips from her skirt to bind it.
I'm fine, he says. It's just a cut. It's not even that deep.
Jules lifts his shirt. She and Mirabella wrap him up tight, using so much of the skirt that Mirabella's legs are visible over the tops of her boots.
I'm all right, Jules.
Joseph touches her face. His hand trembles.
I know,
she replies. You'll be perfectly fine as soon as we get out of here. She puts his arm over her shoulders and nods to Arsinoe.
Right,
Arsinoe says. But she swallows hard, looking at him. There will be plenty more guards to get through when they make it upstairs and into the Volroy proper. She grabs a torch off the wall and takes up one of the fallen guard's clubs.
Mirabella, stay behind me, says Jules. You don't need to be out front to use your gift, do you?
Mirabella shakes her head. As quickly as they can, they move through the last gate and creep up the stairs to the ground level. Near the top, Arsinoe sets down the torch before the light can give them away. There are bound to be many guards here, probably priestesses too. It will take all of them, and the goddess besides, to get clear of the Volroy. And even then, they will probably be instantly stopped in the courtyard. They turn the corner ready to fight, but there is no one there. Only faintly burning candles in the sconces on the walls. And then they see the bodies. Bodies of guards are littered across the ground. Arms and legs stick out from beneath tables and from behind half-closed doors.
What happened here?
Joseph asks. And Jules crouches as a dozen cloaked figures run into view with weapons drawn. The wind quickens through the windows as Mirabella gathers her elements.
Wait! Wait!
The cloaked leader pushes back his hood, and Arsinoe drops her club.
Billy!
She cries and runs into his arms.
Arsinoe!
He lifts her off the ground. He squeezes so tight that she can barely breathe. And kisses her hair and the scars upon her face.
Are you all right?
He asks. I was terrified we would be too late.
I'm fine, Arsinoe says, beaming. But who is we?
A girl steps forward wearing a red-lined cloak.
I remember you, Arsinoe says. From the arena. You were at the duel.
She looks over the rest of them, barely a dozen in total, who have laid waste to every guard on the main floor of the fortress. What are you doing here? The girl regards her with respect and bows slightly.
We are warriors from Bastion City, she says, and nods toward Jules. And we came for her.
Greavesdrake Manor. Catarine wakes in the dark to Nicholas thrashing, jerking, caught in the net of some horrible dream. She reaches out and touches his shoulder, and he eases back to sleep. The room is full of shadows. The candles and lamps have gone out, or been put out. She cannot remember. What she does remember sends heat to her cheeks. Nicholas was so different from Peter, but he is no less passionate. Afterward, he held her tightly, pressed together skin to skin. She rolls toward him and slips her hand beneath the blankets. Nicholas, are you awake? He does not stir. Her king consort is exhausted. She walks her fingers up his chest playfully. Her finger slides in warm liquid. At first she cringes, thinking it is drool. But then she recognizes the scent in the air, the smell of so much warm and sudden blood. Catarine sits up. She leans across to her bedside table for the candle and long matches. Her hands tremble as she lights it, even though she knows what she will see. Nicholas lies dead, covered in blood. It pools atop his chest and in the wrinkles of the fabric, staining the sheet bright red. It has run from his mouth and from his nose, even from his eyes. His veins are a swollen, angry purple beneath his skin, nearly everywhere she touched him. Catarine sits back on her knees and stares down at her new husband. Poor Nicholas. Poor mainland boy, with no gift to help him withstand the toxins. She looks down at her skin, at her hands, at her whole body where the poison resides. The poison inside her must be strong indeed, if it can produce such an effect so quickly. Poor Nicholas. He lay with a queen, and he died for it. Hoofbeats ring across the stones of the drive. Catarine gets quickly out of bed and stuffs her arms into her dressing gown. Natalia! Natalia will help me! She smooths and folds the tangled, blood-soaked bedclothes, breathing hard, beginning to weep. She touches Nicholas's cooling cheek and then pulls the sheet over his face. Natalia cannot arrive and see him that way. I am sorry, she whispers, as footsteps sound in the hall.
Cat, Peter says, and knocks.
I saw your candle from outside. Are you awake?
Peter, Catarine cries. She runs to him and crushes herself to his chest as he comes through the door.
You are trembling. What is...
She closes her eyes. He has seen it, seen what she has done. He draws away to look at her. In the faint, shadowed light, he can only barely make out the crown of ink across her forehead. He touches it with his thumb.
So you have done it, he says sadly. Tell me what has happened.
It falls out of her mouth in a torrent. The farce of a duel, the crowning, the assassination of Arsinoe, her wedding night, and the dead king consort in her bed. When she is finished, she waits, sure that he will shove her away.
My sweet Catarine, he says, and wipes the tears from her cheek.
How can you say that? Her fingers have left streaks of red on his shirt. She tears free and returns to her bedroom, where the shape of Nicholas lies, what is left of his blood pooling in his back and legs. I killed him, just by touching him. There is something wrong with me. Peter steps around her. He takes up a lamp from the table and pulls back the sheet. Catarine turns away when she sees how gray Nicholas's skin has turned and how sunken his eyes. Peter picks up an arm and inspects the fingers.
So much poison, he whispers. She is practically made of it. She is like they said she was, the undead queen. She claws at her own face, disgusted, rubbing the fresh scab of her crown until it smears across her forehead, bloody and black. Peter sets down the lamp and comes to her. He pins her arms to her sides. Stop. You are a queen. You are crowned. And none of this was your fault. You are not surprised, Catherine says. Why?
Peter looks deep into her eyes for a long time, almost as if he expects to find someone else there.
Because after you sent me away, I went to the Breccia domain. I went down into it.
His fingers dig into her skin, and she notices that they are cold.
What do you really remember, Cat, from when you fell?
From when you pushed me, Catherine says, and jerks loose. She lowers her eyes. And I remember nothing.
Nothing? Peter repeats. Perhaps not. Or perhaps you are lying. What I saw there, or what I thought I saw there, made me scream like I have not screamed since I was a child.
She looks up. He knows. The dead queens had gnawed on the bones of their injustices for centuries before he had dropped Catherine right into their laps. That they were able to pour their wishes into her, filling her up with ambition and twisted strength, was his fault.
At least I was not afraid for you anymore, he says quietly. The old sisters would never have let you be killed. Not when you were their way into the crown. Out of that hole.
But it was all for nothing. She stares helplessly at Nicholas graying beneath the sheet. She has become poison. No mainland king may lie with her and survive. No mainland-fathered children could survive the long months in her belly.
I cannot bear the triplets, she whispers. I cannot be the queen.
She begins to weep, and Peter gathers her to him.
Natalia, how disappointed she will be. How disappointed you must be. How disgusted.
Never.
Peter kisses her smeared crown. He kisses her cheeks and kisses away the tears that slip down them.
Peter,
I am poison.
And I am a poisoner. And you have never been more precious to me than you are right now.
He raises his head at the sound of an approaching carriage and wraps his arms around her tighter.
I failed you once. I betrayed you once. But I will not again. From now on, I will protect you, Cat. Whatever happens.
Indrid Down. The warriors in the red-lined cloaks are led by a girl named Emilia Vatros and her father. She has the quick, dispassionate eyes of a hunting bird, and Jules likes her immediately.
Why are you really helping us? Jules asks.
It is like I said, Amelia replies, and Madrigal seconds her. It wasn't hard to get them to come. You were the whole reason they were in the capital.
She should have been sent to us anyway, says Amelia's father, eyeing Madrigal. You should have let her choose, to be yours or to be ours.
She was mine, Madrigal says.
She was born to me. The goddess feels different.
How do you know what the goddess feels? Madrigal snaps, but Jules shushes her. Amelia's father stands as straight as Kate, his hair dark brown and face lightly lined. And if Madrigal engages him in debate, they will stand in the shadows bickering until the sun comes up and their entire party is discovered.
Let's get moving, then, Arsinoe says.
Two warriors come to take Joseph from Jules's shoulders. Jules looks to Arsinoe, and she nods. They will accept help now, and ask questions later. Quickly and quietly, they slip through the main level of the Volroy, running and ducking through the castle keep and the inner cloister, until they reach the arched exterior gateway and hunch in the shadows. Jules swallows nervously,
Amelia has dragged her to the fore, and she cannot help but feel as though her war gift is being tested.
There they are, Amelia whispers, and Jules pushes away from the stone wall of the arch to see what she sees.
Four fast flashes in the dark from their compatriots scouting ahead.
Four flashes, Jules says.
Four guards between us and the edge of the courtyard.
Yes, do you see them?
Jules creeps forward and looks up to the battlements.
She sees two.
Where?
The other two are along the hedge, too close together to take separately.
Whichever died last would shout, raise an alarm.
Amelia unslings her bow.
Can't we wait until they leave? Jules asks, and then slip out toward the forest?
Once they are in the nighttime streets, it will be easy.
Jules still remembers the map of Indrid Down. It is not more than a 20-minute run before they find the meadow, and then the trees for good cover.
We have waited too long as it is. It is a wonder someone has not awoken the entire guard already.
Amelia knocks an arrow and whistles. Across the courtyard, another warrior does the same. Both take aim at the guards chatting near the hedge.
Guide my arrow, Amelia whispers.
What? I can't.
Amelia grins. Yes, you can, she says. But it's all right. I can make the shot without you.
Another whistle, and the arrows fly. Both guards fall with nary a sound.
Hey, Jules growls and grabs Amelia's arm.
Don't do that. We have queens here. Don't waste time by messing about with me.
Amelia cocks her head. Then her eyes dart to the battlements when another warrior whistles.
The battlements! They've seen us!
Jules looks up just as one of the guards fires a crossbow. She flinches and pushes her mind hard, and the bolt bounces off the stones to Amelia's right.
Go, now!
Jules waves for Arsinoe to come. They dash through the courtyard. Guards at the battlements have alerted others, and arrows strike the ground, too close for Jules' liking.
She turns back and pushes out. Out! Sending as many as she can off course.
Even with the blood pounding in her ears, the effort is exhausting. A warrior fires an arrow beside her, and she watches a guard tumble down the wall.
Jules! Arsinoe calls. Come on!
Jules and Amelia turn to run, helped by the cover of the other warriors. As they pass the guards fallen by the hedge, an arm shoots out and grasps Jules's ankle. She flies face first onto the path and rolls to kick, but Amelia leaps over the top of him. She takes his head in the crook of her arm and twists.
Dead now, she says. Let's go.
The fleeing queens and their rescue party dissolve into the streets, some going one way, some another. The layout of the city memorized, they meet in alleys to cross paths, running breathless and silent, until they break into the meadow in twos and threes to dissipate like drops of ink into water.
You were good back there, Amelia grins. I do not like to think of how many poisoned arrows your executioner would have needed to pierce your gift.
How can you say that to her and smile? Arsinoe asks.
How can you talk at all?
Billy asks, panting. He has taken over helping Joseph and struggles beneath the extra weight.
Jules reaches out, but Joseph waves his hand.
I'm fine, Jules, I'm fine.
She steps close and kisses his face. It is cool to the touch and drenched in sweat.
We have to get him to a healer.
We came on a barge, says Amelia's father. It will carry you wherever you wish to go.
Greavesdrake Manor. Catarine's door opens, but the person who bursts in is not who they expect. It is not Natalia. It is Genevieve.
Forgive me, Queen Catarine. I do not wish to interrupt, but I felt you should know.
Genevieve stops when she sees Peter, with Catarine in his arms. Then her mouth drops open at the sight of Nicholas lying dead in the bed.
What?
Genevieve rushes past Catarine and Peter and stares down at the body.
She does not ask whether someone else could have poisoned him. She is enough of a poisoner herself to see what has happened.
Katerine, what have you done?
I did not mean it,
Katerine cries.
It will be all right,
Peter whispers into her hair.
How will it be all right?
Genevieve asks, her lilac eyes wild.
We have made her into poison.
We have made her a queen crowned, says Peter.
No, Katerine says. How can I be, Peter, if I can take no king consort, if I cannot bear the triplets?
The poison may fade in time, says Peter, but his voice is doubtful. Genevieve slumps against the bed. Her hand slides in a puddle of cooling blood, and she shakes it off, splattering the sheets. As she leans toward the lamp for something to wipe herself clean with, the light shows her face, swollen from crying.
Genevieve? Katerine says.
What is wrong? Genevieve's arms fall to her lap. She seems to shrink right in front of them.
Natalia is dead.
Murdered.
Katerine freezes. That cannot be right. Natalia murdered? No one would dare, no one could.
There must be some mistake, says Peter.
Who? Who did it?
It does not matter who. We are over. Finished. Genevieve's fingers wrap around the corner of the bedsheet, shaking.
Look at this dead king. The temple will not have this, nor the council.
She looks around desperately as if she will find Natalia there somewhere, hiding.
What are we to do?
We will have to stop Mirabella's execution. Give her the crown instead. How those Westwoods are going to laugh.
Stop it.
Peter storms across the room. He grabs Genevieve by the arm and drags her to her feet.
Tell us what happened to Natalia. Tell us now.
William Chatworth strangled her, Genevieve says. The war priestess found him and put her knife into his chest. But by then it was too late. A fat tear rolls down Katerine's face.
Too late.
And the murderer dead as well, so she cannot have her vengeance, cannot poison him for days, for weeks like he deserved. She would have crafted something for him to make him spasm so hard he broke his own back.
Katerine clutches at her stomach. Such pain, such anger boils up inside of her that she can feel even the dead queen's cower.
Natalia,
she whispers.
My mother.
Where is she?
Peter asks.
We would see her.
She is at the Volroy, being guarded by priestesses.
Perhaps they will let you in.
Genevieve wipes at her own tears.
Before they execute Katerine as an abomination.
You are a disgrace, Peter says suddenly. He had been staring out the window toward the Volroy as they spoke. Now he shoves Genevieve down onto the bed beside the dead king consort.
No one is going to execute our queen. No true Aaron would allow it.
Genevieve jumps to her feet, fists trembling.
Natalia is dead, she shouts. Do you not hear what I am saying?
Outside, below the window, the sound of hoofbeats announces another rider. It is a messenger.
They have escaped,
he calls up to the house.
The queens! They have escaped the cells and are gone!
Queens?
Katerine asks.
How is it, queens? I poisoned Arsinoe myself.
What are we to do?
Genevieve moans.
I am not Natalia. I do not...
Be silent, Genevieve, and listen to me, Peter says.
Cat, listen. No one can be allowed inside here, do you understand? No one can see this body.
What will we do with it? Katerine asks.
With him?
We will make up a tale. Peter takes her face in his hands. And you will be the queen crowned like we planned. He looks at Genevieve.
Like we promised.
He straightens his clothes and smooths his hair. He goes to bar the door.
We will find Mirabella
and Arsinoe if she indeed still lives, and we will kill them. With no queens left, the temple will have no choice.
I do not understand, Genevieve says. If she still cannot bear the triplets...
That does not matter. Peter closes the door and turns the key in the lock. Katarine will be the queen crowned, he says. It is just that she will be the last. The Indradown Woods.
Arsinoe's bear greets their running party by standing on his hind legs. He hardly knows these fast people in red-lined cloaks and swats at them defensively as they pass. Arsinoe stops below his chest. She is too out of breath to say his name, but his nose sniffs the air eagerly, and he lowers onto her shoulders, smothering her in bear fur and rolling her roughly around on the ground.
Braddock, she says when she is able. You're safe.
He is safe, but not the same. He is fur and bones. Those poisoners had not known how to feed him properly.
We should not tarry here long, says Amelia, and looks meaningfully at the queens.
She is far more used to giving orders than taking them. Arsinoe could tell that at first glance.
Jules! Kara!
Jules and her aunt embrace beneath the weight of Joseph's arm. It took Jules and Billy both to support him and help him through the forest.
Can you help him? Jules asks, but Joseph tugs free.
I'm all right, he says. Just bind it tighter.
Arsinoe gets to her feet. She turns Joseph into the moonlight and slaps his hands away when he tries to stop her. She lifts the bandage. Kara leans down and looks for only a moment, before straightening again.
You see? Joseph smiles. It's nothing. A scratch.
Kara's eyes are wide and soft.
Good, Jules says, but she kisses Joseph very hard.
One sob escapes her as she takes his hand and holds him up, but one sob only. She presses her forehead to his. Arsinoe turns to Mirabella. Of course she has been listening. Her knuckles are pressed to her lips.
What if we took him back into the city? Arsinoe asks. It's Indra down. They have the best healers there. They must.
No, says Joseph. I'm fine. I'm going with you wherever that is. So where is it?
Arsinoe touches his face. He will be all right. He must be. Joseph Sandrin is one half of Jules.
There are doctors on the mainland, Billy suggests. Good ones. Surgeons far better than here. And it's a short sail through the mist. We can come back and find you, he adds when Joseph starts to protest.
No, Arsinoe says. That's good. That's where we're going anyway.
Everyone stops and stares at her, even Mirabella.
You could return to your cities, Madrigal suggests, and gather support there. Not everyone will back the council's decision to execute you.
We could take you, says Amelia. Hide you in Bastion City.
We would welcome you, Jeuien, you and anyone whom you wished us to protect.
Jules looks from Amelia to Arsinoe. Then she looks down. Before the ascension began, Arsinoe always thought she would find her way back to Wolf Spring, that the madness of the year would pass and everything would return to normal. Days spent with Jules at the Malone house, nights beside a warm fire inside the Lion's Head with Billy and Joseph, with Kate and Ellis, Luke and his handsome rooster Hank. But that life, that good, familiar, and precious time, is over. The alliance between queens might hold long enough to topple Katarine, but afterward, the people would want them to start all over again. It would be Mirabella or herself, one to kill the other. That is how it has always been.
Are you sure you want to do this? Arsinoe asks her sister.
I will not go back, Mirabella says solemnly. The council ordered my death, and they went along with it. Luca went along with it.
Arsinoe takes a deep breath.
a queen sits upon the throne. The island has no more need of them. She must let them go. She has to. So we make for Barden Harbor, says Arsinoe. Let's steal a boat big enough to get us off this goddess-forsaken island.
Barden Harbor. Jules helped the warriors call the small river barge that took them into Barden Harbor. It was not much, barely large enough to fit them all, and nowhere near sturdy enough to brave the rough waters of the sea. But they climbed aboard. Now Jules stands beside the warriors, pushing it with her mind. Joseph chuckles, watching Camden at Jules's knee, training all her cougar focus on the barge as well.
Look at our girl, he says to Arsinoe, sitting beside him on the barge with her hand pressed hard to the wound in his side. She's outgrowing us.
That's not true, but she supposes that it is. She and Joseph have both been chasing after Jules since they were children.
He chuckles again and winces.
Here, she says. Let me bind that tighter.
No, Arsinoe. It's fine.
Joseph, you have bled through the bandage. You should have stayed behind with Aunt Kara, found a healer.
And missed the adventure?
He smiles his lopsided Joseph smile.
You're wincing.
Yes, my side is sore because there's a hole in it. Once we reach the mainland, Billy will take me to a doctor, and they'll sew me up right and proper.
The barge continues through the moonlight, skimming across the dark surface of the river. Arsinoe looks back. Warriors stayed behind to run decoy in case of pursuit. Kara and Braddock stayed behind as well.
There was no getting the bear on the barge, Arsinoe, Joseph says, reading her thoughts.
I know.
You did save him, and Kara will take good care of him at the Black Cottage.
Stream-caught fish and berries for the rest of his days, and he will be safe, but she will never see him again.
Jules leaves the warriors and comes to squat beside them. She touches Joseph's cheek, and Camden climbs atop his legs to keep him warm.
Is he all right?
He is still conscious and can answer for himself, he says.
It's not much longer now, Jules says, and as she looks out worriedly at the river, the small barge seems to move faster.
If the warriors notice, they do not acknowledge it, but Madrigal, Mirabella, and Billy all look over their shoulders.
Good, Joseph says. Fishers are up early. If we want to steal a boat, we won't have much time.
They reach the mouth of the river, and Barden Harbor slides into view. The boats docked at the port are much larger than the vessels in Sealhead Cove. Their masts rise through the pre-dawn fog. These are far-ranging ships, built to chase frothbacks across the open sea, with smaller whaleboats lashed to their sides. They are too big to be sailed with such a skeleton crew, but that is what Mirabella is for. And they will need a large vessel if the sea decides to put up any kind of fight. The barge nudges silently up against the nearest dock, disturbing nothing but a couple of roosting gulls.
Slowly?
Slowly, Madrigal says, as she helps Mirabella off the barge. These docks are unfamiliar, and the moon gives us only so much light.
Billy helps Arsinoe and Jules to lift Joseph, and grimaces at all the blood. Arsinoe flashes a bracing smile.
It'll be all right, she says.
I hope so. You queens do have a way of working things out. All right, Joseph. Don't dawdle. You weigh more than your slender frame would suggest.
He takes Joseph off their hands and aids him as he limps down the dock.
Are you ready, Jules? Arsinoe asks.
But Jules turns back to Madrigal and to Amelia and the warriors.
I'm right behind you, she says.
Jules watches her friends creep along the docks. In the thick morning mist, they look like magic, like fairies stealing in and out of view.
You won't really go, will you, Jules? Madrigal asks.
Her hand is on her belly. She is always so worried about her unborn baby. Jules reaches out and touches her mother's stomach. Try to make peace with Aunt Kara. She's your sister, and a midwife now. She can help you with this.
Peace. There may be no peace, but I will have this baby at the Black Cottage, if you will go there with me, Madrigal says.
But Jules does not reply. It will be better if she leaves. Better for Wolf Spring. Without her, the Black Council might decide to leave well enough alone. Goddess knows they will have enough to deal with after this debacle of an ascension.
You should stay with us, Amelia says fiercely. Let the queens and the mainlanders go.
I am her guardian. Jules's eyes follow Arsinoe through the harbor. And I will remain her guardian until the end.
This is where it ends, says Amelia. Though not for you. I sense a great destiny for you, Jeuienne Malone.
She offers her hand, steady as a stone. The warriors came to her aid for no other reason than she was one of theirs. They would take her, and even Camden, and Jules would very much like to see the halls of Bastion City.
Looking after her will be a great destiny.
On the docks, Arsinoe leads Mirabella by the hand. The affection between them is easy and natural, and it makes Jules' chest ache. Her place beside Arsinoe is less now that Mirabella is there. She does not need Jules like she used to.
I can't let her go alone, Jules says. There are still battles to fight.
She turns to face the warriors and her mother. And I can't let Joseph go either. Amelia's eyes flash, but she holds her tongue, and Jules and Camden step off the barge. It rocks as their weight leaves it.
When your battle is over, Amelia says, we will be here.
Until then, be well. Take care of your queen. She smiles down at Camden in the moonlight. And your cat. Amelia pushes off, and the barge slides quietly through the water, returning to rejoin the rest of the warriors. Madrigal paces along the edge, but there is no danger of her jumping. She presses a kiss to her palm and raises it in a wave. Perhaps she is crying, but if she is, through the fog, Jules cannot see it. Mirabella waits nervously as Billy and Arsinoe loose their ship from its moorings. There is a sadness in her and an uneasiness, but underneath she hums with excitement, preparing to face the open waves and the mists and the goddess who would see them dead. It is like Luca told her that day. It is clear that she is right where she belongs.
Are you sure it's not too big for you? Joseph asks doubtfully.
She has Joseph's arm slung across her shoulders.
They have not crafted a ship that is too big for me.
Footfalls and paw steps sound across the dock, and Jules slides in under Joseph's other arm.
Let me help, she says,
and she and Mirabella take him across the gangplank. They ease him down beside the portside rail on the main deck.
Can you secure him? Mirabella asks.
Can you break us through the mist? Jules asks back, and begins to lash him down with ropes. Mirabella pushes the wind and the current, and the boat rocks forward. Jules nearly loses her footing and looks up at her sourly. But then she smiles. Billy and Arsinoe ready the sails, and Mirabella goes to the foredeck. She looks back at the shore, at the island. Even had she won the crown and ruled, she would have left the island eventually. But she never thought it would be like this. A fugitive queen, and without even saying goodbye to her dearest Bree and Elizabeth.
Are you ready? Arsinoe asks, a bit breathless from tugging ropes.
Billy is at the helm to help her steer, but he will not need to help much.
The people we leave behind, says Mirabella. They will take care of one another.
I hope so, Arsinoe replies.
I think so.
Mirabella turns to face the gray morning sea.
Then yes, I am ready.
The Volroy. High in the West Tower, Katarine and Peter await news of the escaped queens. The High Priestess is there as well, and the Black Council, not to mention a gaggle of priestesses and Sarah Westwood. They would have admitted Kate or Madrigal Malone, too, had either of them bothered to come to the city for the duel.
"Where is your king consort?" High Priestess Luca asks, and Genevieve's eyes dart around wildly.
Peter is going to have to glue her eyes shut to keep from giving them away.
"At Greavesdrake, High Priestess," Katarine replies, "resting."
They are surprisingly sedate, this group, waiting calmly and with something that looks like patience. But it is not truly patience. It is shock. Their fugitive queens have broken out of their cells, and every person in the room feels the space where Natalia Aaron should be.
"This should never have happened," Antonin says, seated at a dark oval table with his head in his hands. "Two poisoner queens in the same cycle? Queen Arsinoe should have come to us. She should have been ours to raise."
"Along with you, Queen Katarine," Genevieve says quickly, and Antonin looks up.
"Of course, along with her."
Katarine smiles through closed lips.
"Of course."
But Arsinoe seems to have been the stronger poisoner. Had they been raised together, Katarine would have lived only until Mirabella was killed. Then she would have found herself at the sharp end of a knife, possibly held by an Aaron.
Katarine turns toward the door. A messenger is arriving, and the gathered people rise from their chairs.
"What news of Mirabella?" Luca asks sharply. "What news of the queens?"
"We were too late," the boy says, breathless. "They escaped on a ship."
"And you did not give chase?" Peter snaps, but the poor messenger looks at the ground.
"There would have been little point with Mirabella at the helm," Luca answers for him. "With her wind and her currents, no one was going to catch them."
"A gift as strong as hers, she might have sunk them for trying," Sarah adds, and Katarine narrows her eyes.
"What direction did they sail?" Luca asks.
Katarine drifts through the room, to the eastward-facing windows. From there, she can see clear past the port and on to the sea. But there is no tiny ship fleeing up the coast to Roland. There is no tiny ship anywhere that she can see.
"They sailed straight out, High Priestess," the boy says. "Straight out and away to the east." "They must be found," Peter says. "Stopped."
When no one hurries to move, he turns on them angrily.
"It was you who decreed their fates. Will none of you now enforce the decree?"
Katarine places her hands atop the cold stone sill of the window. On her forehead, her scabbed crown has been wiped and made clean, once again a fine black band. She stares into the distance and feels the muttering of the dead queens deep in her bones. She has done what they wanted, become what they intended. Across her city, the dawn grows bright. It shines off the black buildings and cobblestone streets, hewing them orange and pink. Katarine looks past the island and over the shimmering water. In the distance, the sky has remained dark. Storm clouds are gathering, and when she listens closely, she hears lightning crackling softly over faraway water.
"Do not worry, Peter," Katarine says, and their bickering stops.
She turns and smiles a queen's smile, with a queen's confidence. Then she looks back at the sea and the confrontation that is about to take place there.
"Neither of my sisters will be returning to the island. The crown and the throne are mine."
The sea. Arsinoe steps up to the railing and watches the shore move farther and farther away. If they manage to pass through the net of mist, they will watch the whole island grow smaller until it is only a shape, and then a dot, and then gone. Something furry brushes her shoulder. Camden, paws on the rail beside her, growling down at the waves. Arsinoe ruffles the big cat's scruff and pulls her down to take her back to Jules. Joseph smiles up at her from Jules' arms.
"Here we are again," he says. "The three of us, in a boat."
Arsinoe tries to laugh, but he is so pale. The makeshift bandages are soaked through with blood. "We should put Cam below," she says to Jules. "Somewhere soft or in a crate, before the journey turns rough."
"Will you put her there for me?" Jules asks.
She will not leave Joseph. Not until they find a healer on the mainland. Arsinoe takes the cougar below to find a space for her.
"Put her in a cabin," Billy says, following her down. "That will be the safest spot."
They find the best one together, and Arsinoe kisses Camden's head before shutting her inside.
"How soon can we get to the mainland?"
"I think that depends on Mirabella, doesn't it? And the mist. I mean, I don't like to think about what happened the last time."
Before he can say anything foolish, Arsinoe throws her arms around him and kisses him. He is surprised and stiff, but it is better this time, without a mouthful of poison. She leans into his chest, and he holds her tightly. It is better than a great number of things.
"We'd better get back up," she says after she lets him go.
"Right. Back up," he mumbles, and follows her up the stairs.
They have left Barden Harbor behind. The guards from the wakened city were too late, and their horses' hooves skidded to a stop on the shore. No one bothered to unmoor a ship to give chase, knowing that they could not catch up to Mirabella. And now, the dawn spills across the water in a thousand yellow sparkles, and the sea is calm. Perhaps they have truly been let go, and the mist will part like a drawn-back curtain. The winds ruffle their collars at first, and whip a little hair into their eyes. For as long as the skies remain clear, they pretend it is only wind, a good sailing wind, to help them along. When the first of the mist slithers across the waves, they try to pretend it is only fog, or froth. But soon enough, the mist is a wall, and the storm is a gale. It is the goddess bearing down.
"Do you think she still wants to keep us?" Arsinoe shouts as she stands beside Mirabella on the foredeck.
Mirabella keeps her arms thrust down at her sides as she concentrates.
"Perhaps it is one last test."
No one says that they should turn back, but every one of them is afraid. The net of mist lies heavily atop the water, white and so very thick.
"Do not fear it," Mirabella shouts. "Easy for you to say. You don't know what it's like to try to pass through, how it chokes you and turns you around."
Mirabella takes Arsinoe by the hand. "Are you ready, sister?" she asks.
"I am. We go through, or we sink."
Mirabella pushes wind into the sails so hard that the entire ship jumps forward like a horse, breaking its harness. The storm is as fine a storm as Mirabella has ever seen. She would be in love with it, were it not trying to stand in their way.
"Go back with them," she says to Arsinoe. "Are you sure?"
"Yes. Go back with them and hold tight to something." She looks at her little sister's terrified face as seawater slams over the rail. She smiles.
"Hold tight to Billy, perhaps."
Arsinoe's eyes shift away from the storm, and she manages a laugh.
"If you say so."
Mirabella watches her go. Jules has her arms wrapped around Joseph, and gripping tight to ropes, soaked and miserable-looking already. Arsinoe joins Billy at the helm, and they cling to the wheel as the ship rises and falls. Mirabella turns back to the storm. The electricity in the air hums in her elemental veins. The dawn is gone. All is dark. The waves raise them up, only to send them crashing back down, and the first of the lightning crackles across the sky. The net of mist swallows the boat to curl around the port side in thick, white fingers. Mirabella sends them surging ahead. She uses the wind to push the mist away. She calls more rain, more lightning to dance with the storm of the island. If the goddess truly wanted to keep her, then she should not have chosen a storm as the means to try. Beneath the warring storms, it is dark as midnight. Only lightning illuminates their way, and it is terrifying, near constant. Arsinoe has never seen lightning strike lightning before, and after this is over, she has no care to again. Together, she and Billy fight to keep the wheel steady, half steering and half holding on to keep from being washed overboard. Joseph and Jules huddle together near the railing, arms wrapped around ropes. Mirabella stands alone on the foredeck, using one storm to fight the other.
"I don't know how much longer we can do this," Billy shouts between the thunder. "I don't know how much longer she can."
Arsinoe's teeth chatter in the wet and the wind, her jaw clacking too hard to reply. They crest a wave and slam down. She bites her lip and tastes warm salt, but cannot tell whether it is blood or the sea. A wave tilts the deck hard to starboard, and for one frozen moment, it seems they will not come back upright. But they do. She barely has time to sigh with relief before another wave hits. With so much force, it feels like being slammed into a wall.
"Are you all right?"
Billy shouts, and she nods, coughing. There is so much water and cold. She wipes salt from her eyes. Mirabella is still upright amid everything, and Arsinoe smiles. She does not know how anyone ever expected that she or Catarine could stand against that. Jules grabs Joseph by the arm and hauls him to her chest as the waves batter them against the railing.
"Joseph, hold on to me.
Hold on to me and don't let go."
"I will never," he says, his voice soft and clear, so close to her neck. His breathing is shallow, and he no longer shivers. She draws back to look into his eyes. There is too much seawater for tears. "What will we do?" she asks gently, "when we reach the mainland?"
"Anything we want."
His eyes drift shut.
"There is a great school there, and bells that ring like music.
We can learn anything we like."
"Anything," she says, "and everything, and we will be together."
"We will be, just like I planned."
He smiles that Joseph smile, and Jules kisses him, even after she no longer feels him kissing back. The storm pitches them back and forth in the mist, but Mirabella clings to the rail like a barnacle, even though she is panting and the strength is leaving her legs. The mist still holds them like a net.
"I've got you, sister," Arsinoe says. "I'll help you."
Mirabella blinks. Somehow Arsinoe fought her way across the deck. Somehow she is standing and pulling Mirabella back onto her feet. She slips her fingers into Mirabella's hand and squeezes.
"I'm no elemental," Arsinoe says, "but I am still a queen."
Mirabella laughs. She screams, and they face down the storm one more time as wind pushes the sails taut and the waves strike hard enough to tear at their clothes. Perhaps if Catarine were there, and they were three together, it would have all gone easier. But as it is, they are only two, and the goddess takes that much more convincing. When the storm dies, it dies so quickly that Mirabella's storm continues to rage for long moments before she realizes. She trembles, and Arsinoe catches her when she seems about to fall. Around them, the white mist swirls and parts, revealing sunlight on the water.
and in the distance, the dark shape of land.
"That's it!" Billy shouts. "That's home! I'd know it anywhere!"